And, you know, people probably looked at that and thought, well, who does he think he is? You know, just because he's got the second name Eubank, he's doing all this stuff in the ring and acting like that, and I don't like him. Whereas other people love that because it's different. That life I was living, that double life, that street life, and it was a double life because after those situations, I was going home to a mansion and then waking up and then going to private school. But then once I'm out of private school, I'm back on the streets with these kids. I'm street fighting. I'm running around Brighton, running around the city and doing things I shouldn't do. If you're doing it for any other reason than the love of the sport, you're going to get hurt and you're not going to make it. You know, some people, especially early on in my career, was like, oh, well, he's just doing it for the money. He's going to make a quick payday, have a couple of fights, make some money, and then go on Big Brother or something like that, you know what I mean? And that's fair enough because, you know, that's what's that you know, that's what, I could have easily done that. But if you're doing it for those reasons, for those superficial reasons, for money or fame or whatever, you're just never going to make it because there's going to be so many times where you're going to be in positions where it's going to be so painful, so hard, so gritty, that you're going to, if you were only in it for those reasons, you'd be like, you know what, screw this, I'm going to find another way.
Welcome to Boxing Life Stories with me, Tris Dixon. I'm joined for Season 2, Episode 18 by middleweight contender Chris Eubank Jr. Chris is currently the WBA's number one contender to face Saul Canelo Alvarez. His name's right there in the mix, having beaten Matt Korobov via an injury in December in New York. Chris is going to be known to most of you. He probably, you know, I find Chris a really engaging and interesting guy. I'm not going to lie. He's a pleasure to spend time with. I find him intelligent. He shirks no question. He answered some pretty tough stuff in here. We talked about stuff he probably would have preferred not to talk about. But you know what I'm like. And he was, I always like his company. I did a big piece with him for BT, No Filter Boxing, which you can check out on YouTube, and I really enjoyed that, as I enjoyed this. Made me feel welcome at his home in Brighton. And I think, you know, it's very different when someone has a public persona. That's kind of what you expect and what you learn to, or what you anticipate from them. And so I remember the first time I was speaking to Chris, I was just there thinking, sat there at the breakfast bar in his house, thinking he's just normal. Just a guy. And during this conversation, I know obviously we don't do video, but you know, he's smiling, he's laughing, he's sort of grinning, he's sort of rolling his eyes. There's lots of expressions, there's lots of, I'm not sure it goes as far as emotion, but there's lots of intricacies in his mannerisms and in his behavior, which means he's not the stoic, emotionless guy that you often see in front of the camera. I like speaking to the guy. He's got something to say for himself. It's interesting. He's put himself in this position where he's now the WBA's number one. He probably won't get the shot, certainly not ahead of Billy Joe Saunders or Callum Smith, who seem to be the front runners for May. But he's there and he's in the conversation. And he's done that through a series of big wins. Yep, you can say he's lost to Billy Joe Saunders and George Groves. That's fine. Hardly any disgrace losing to those guys. We talk here about Chris's background, his upbringing in Las Vegas, of all places, how that shaped and molded his character, We talk about his pro career, highs and lows so far, and the future. We covered a lot of bases. Yeah, there's not for me, there's not much not to like about Chris Eubank Jr. And we also talk about Gogglebox, which, you know, I offered him. We mentioned here about Smarties, where there was that line which went viral about his dad calling Smarties a stupendous confectionery. I should have got Chris to talk about that a little bit more, but we did talk about Gogglebox nonetheless, and he makes some salient points about what it's done for his career and the sort of audience it's taken him to. You know, the guy knows the game, the guy knows how to play the game, the guy knows the business, and he got that from some of his from his father, of course, who tried to warn him away from getting involved in the business. Still, loads of interesting stuff. I really hope you enjoy it. I hope you see a different side to Chris. I think there's both sides in there, to be fair. I think you see the guy behind Chris Eubank, and in there, I think you see the fight inside of him, the guy who's still in fight mode for the very sense that his career is still at play, and he probably doesn't want his guard to drop too deep while he's still fighting, which is perfectly understandable. Anyway, for want of waffling, I will bring you to a word from our sponsors. Hanson Lee Resourcing are proud sponsors of Boxing Life Stories. They're a multi-award-winning provider of technology and business change professionals across the UK, Europe, US and Asia Pacific regions. Not only do they find the best people, but they'll help you retain them. Discover more at hansonlee.com. Delco Safety Compliance are a leading provider of professional fire, asbestos and safety services to businesses nationwide. They offer one expert point of contact for all of your fire, health and safety compliance needs. Find out more at www.delcosafety.co.uk. And now here's Chris Eubank Jr. So Chris, thanks for having me over. Here we are in 2020. Are you where you thought you'd be?
Am I where I thought I would be? Yes. You know, I'm there's a lot to look forward to this year. So, you know, in terms of the position I'm in, yes, I am where I thought I would be. I thought I would have had one extra fight. You know, it was a 3-fight deal I had. I only fought twice last year, just due to the, you know, the fickleness of boxing and, you know, how things don't go to plan sometimes. But, you know, the projections for this year are, you know, at least 3 fights, very active. And after the, you know, the Khabib win, I'm in prime position now to go forward and get these belts. So, yeah.
You mentioned there about the landscape of boxing. It hasn't always been all straightforward for you, has it? You've had your road bumps and you've learned some pretty important lessons as you've gone along.
Absolutely. I don't think anybody has a smooth journey, a smooth ride. Everybody hits those bumps in the road. I've hit my fair share, and
some you didn't see coming.
No, yeah, but you know, the important thing about that is that I've learned from all of those bumps, all those hits, all of those trips. I've learned from them. I've made myself a better man and a better fighter because of them. So, you know, I actually am grateful for those. For those missteps and those learning curves, because, you know, they have made me a better fighter. They made me a better person, more experienced, you know. And yeah, you know, 2020 is a very, very important year for me. You know, I've done a lot in the sport, but there's still a lot more that I need to do, and. You know, I'm in prime position now to go forward and get into some big fights, have some big wins and win some big belts.
Your dad did warn you about the pitfalls of boxing, didn't he? He's gone on record numerous times saying he's not a fan of the business of boxing. Mm-hmm. Even with that vision, you can't legislate for the landscape of boxing shifting around you, can you?
No. That's one thing you can't do is try and control or predict the things that happen in the game. Things are always changing. You know, people, you always ask me, you know, they've always asked me, you know, what's your plan for the next 2-3 years, or what's your plan for the next year? You can't answer it. There's just, you know, one minute you think you're fighting this guy, and then he pulls out, or, you know, another belt becomes available, or some belt's taken away, or there's a failed drug test, or it just there's no way to pin down an exact route. You just have to, no pun intended, roll with the punches. You got to just go with the flow and be as prepared as you can for any and every situation that is going to come at you, because they're all going to come at you. You've just got to be prepared.
With your name, your stock, your value, and what you've achieved as a fighter, though, it does often put you on the A side of the bargaining table, which is stronger than being on the B side, though, for sure.
Yeah, but that has been earned. That's been earned through years of victories, years of top performances, exciting performances, fan-friendly fights. You know, it hasn't been given to me. I've worked for everything. So, you know, now I am at a stage where I can call the shots in certain situations. And that's what I've been doing.
You've beaten the likes of Chudinov, Spike O'Sullivan, Nick Blackwell, Abraham Yildirim. Do you think you get the credit you deserve?
I don't actually, no. I'm not complaining, you know, it's just one of those things. People always want more. You know, you can, you know, Anthony experienced it. You know, he was Mr. Perfect.
You're talking AJ.
Yes.
Yep.
Couldn't put a foot wrong. Everybody loved him. Everybody still loves him. But as soon as he had one slip up, people switched on him. That's the harshness of the sport. You know, you have your core fans, but then you've got, you know, the casuals or just the people that only really see you as good as your last fight. You know, one slip up, one bad performance, one loss seems to be able to erase a lot of people's memories of everything you've done before that, which is unfair, but I don't know, I guess it's human nature, or maybe it's just boxing nature, I don't know. I've had a lot of great wins, a lot of great fights. Some people like to forget those performances, but at the end of the day, you know, as long as I'm making money, as long as I'm moving forward, as long as I'm happy, I'm not really too worried about the armchair critics and the haters and the doubters. I've been dealing with it for my entire career since day one, and it's something I've been able to learn how to just block out.
It's funny, you mentioned AJ being popular, and he obviously turned over as the golden boy, and people were on board the AJ train from the start. Your train was different. You divided people right from the start.
Yep.
Why was that? Why didn't you get the same platform? Was it just the gold medal? Was it because of your dad? Was it because of the first fight with the Simply the Best and the jump over the top rope? Do you think that condemned you to being divisive even?
Yeah, I mean, obviously AJ was, you know, if you win a gold medal, you've got huge support, you've got a huge backing.
But your other friend, James DeGale, won a gold and he got booed in his debut.
Did he?
Yeah. In Birmingham.
Well, I mean, James DeGale is notoriously known for being an asshole outside of the ring. I don't know if that has anything to do with that, him being booed. You know, it doesn't matter how many gold medals you have, if you're not a good guy, you know, people are going to know. People are going to tell you about yourself. I don't know if that was the case with DeGale, but with Anthony, you know, he's a humble guy, you know, heavyweight, gold medalist, good person. There was no way that he wasn't ever going to have a massive following leading into the pros. For me, you know, not too many amateur fights, 26 amateur fights, half of them in the States where nobody saw. You know, an extremely controversial figure in my father, who, yes, has a legion of fans, but also, you know, a lot of people that maybe didn't like how he was throughout his career, being this showman and this entertainer and this brash guy who did all these crazy things. So, you know, 100% some of the people that weren't his fans or didn't like him, that was, of course, always going to trickle down to his son before they even knew who I was. You know, oh, I don't like him because I don't like his dad.
Did he warn you about that?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I didn't have to be warned. It's common sense. You know, he was, especially early in his career, he was kind of, you know, a lot of people didn't like him. A lot of people hated him. It was only kind of towards the end of his career where he turned it all around and people started to love him. And now he is, you know, this icon. But, you know, there was always those, even he was, they say people love to hate him. So that hate would obviously transfer down to me, and it did. And I'm sure there are still people that won't give me a chance just because of the fact they didn't like my dad, no matter what I do. You know, and it doesn't help that we have the same name. So that may have been, you know, a reason why people were divided. I am also not, I'm not your everyday fighter. You know, I vault the ropes. I've got, you know, I've got an opinion. I am an entertainer in terms of I'm not just your jumping, get in the ring, throw your 1-2s, and you know, thanks everybody, good night. I'm, you know, I'm exciting. I do things differently in the ring. I'll look at the camera. I'll jump the ropes. I'll do certain things in the ring that, you know, maybe the purists in the sport won't appreciate. And you know, people probably looked at that and thought, well, who does he think he is? You know, just because he's got the second name Eubank, he's doing all this stuff in the ring and acting like that, and I don't like him. Whereas other people love that because it's different.
It's important to stand out.
It is, absolutely. This is the entertainment game. This is not the be the same as everyone else game. And unfortunately, there are, you know, 95% of the fighters on the planet, they are all the same. You know, they just go in there, they fight. They don't have anything to say for themselves. They don't have any flair and anything really that separates themselves. They're just good fighters. In this day and age, being a good fighter is just not enough. In no way, shape or form is it enough. And that's proven by the fact that you've got guys like KSI and Logan Paul who can go into a ring and earn millions of dollars with two fights under their belts. They're not great fighters, but they are entertainers. They have legions of fans who love them and love what they do. And so they were able to profit from boxing. And that is the same in boxing. You know, if you're just a normal guy, yes, you will have your people that appreciate what you can do and stuff like that, but you need to have that edge. You need to have that something that's going to separate yourself from the crowd for people to really get behind you and really want to follow you. Look at Conor McGregor. You know, the guy is... he had one... He'd never had a professional boxing match, as far as I knew, and the guy made more than...
The rest of boxing together,
yeah,
probably.
Exactly. Yeah. You have to be a character. You have to be somebody that people can get behind or that people can hate.
Does that come naturally to you, or do you have to force it?
No, you can never force. I mean, you can try, but people will always see through it. You can only pretend for so long.
So what the public sees is you doing you. Not you doing you for the sake of
absolutely.
Other people.
And there are probably some people that think, oh, he's just doing that because of his dad, or, you know, I don't know. But you just can't. It's impossible to be in the fights and the situations I've been in throughout the years, and not to just be who you are, it's impossible. You know, I've always been naturally, I've always naturally stood out from the crowd. I've always liked to be that guy that's different from the rest. Some people love it. Most people love it. Some people don't. But everybody wants to see it. You know, when the fights happen, when my fights happen, people are watching. People are buying their tickets. People are tuning in on TV. People are talking about it. They're not going to the clubs. They're not doing anything else on a Saturday night apart from watching me. Some fighters don't have that pull. Some fighters, you know, even if they are good, outside of their core, hardcore boxing fan base, you know, people are happy to just find out the result on Sunday or watch a replay. I'm not that type of fighter.
Do you think people get you as a person?
I think my fans do, for sure. I mean, that can only... I don't think I'm a bad guy. I think I'm a good guy. I'm a decent guy, a stand-up guy. So the people that may not like me, the only reason I can think is because they just don't understand me. They don't know who I am. Maybe all they've ever seen is me being this confident fighter in the ring. You know, and that's all they've got to go off of in terms of who I am. They don't know how I am as a person outside of them. They don't see me doing the charity work and spending time with the kids and mentoring and giving everybody my time. You know, never cursing, never being disrespectful to people. I just guess they just don't see that, or they don't know that part of me. And I think that's maybe something that I've got to work on moving forward, in terms of outside of the ring, maybe being more of more active. You know, I've got this. I was on Gogglebox last year, and that has opened up a whole new
audience.
Yeah. You know, I've got little girls come up to me, oh yeah, I watch you on TV, and
sharing their smarties with you.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm you know, more of that stuff I think will help project me as a person to the public. And I got really good feedback off of that, because they saw a side to me maybe that they just didn't know was there, you know, with my relationship with my father and that.
Well, you were a great double act, weren't you? Because your dad's obviously eccentric and comes out with some corkers, and you're deadpan. And so everyone's losing their mind at your dad, and you're just there like it's normal, because obviously you're used to it. But as a double act, it worked very well, I thought, and that's probably why you're getting the feedback. And I thought some of that stuff, does it challenge you to keep a straight face sometimes with some of the stuff he says?
Yeah, I mean, even though he's my dad and I've heard it all and I've been around it my entire life, you know, there's still something you say, and I'm just like, hold on a second, what's going on here? And, you know, the crazy thing is there was so much stuff that wasn't, that was edited out. You know, there was some great stuff that they didn't use, that I'm actually going to probably post some of the stuff, actually. I'm glad you reminded me, because I've got some of the outtakes of stuff they didn't use, deleted scenes and that. But yeah, it was fun, and I'm going to be doing a lot more of that type of thing moving forward. So I think that's good, and I think that will get the people that maybe don't understand me and don't know me as a person to be able to see certain sides of me that they didn't know were there.
We did mention before when I came and spoke to you for BT about your facial expressions and how stoic you are. Because we talk about you being emotionless, and some people will perceive it as arrogance. But I said just then it was almost deadpan. It's because you don't give much away, isn't it?
I guess that's what makes me such an excellent poker player.
Because you're a closed book.
I don't know. People say I'm very hard to read. I mean, in the ring, I'm emotionless for sure. outside of the ring, I think I'm you know, I'm not the most open book, not by any means, but I'm, you know, I'm a fun guy.
Have you cried in the last 15, 20 years?
You know what? I haven't cried since I was about 12 years old. But I was watching a film. What was the film called? My friend. Hold on, let me remember the film name. So yeah, I'm friends with an actor called Daniel Kaluuya. Very famous actor, British, and he made a film called Queen and Slim. This was the film that I watched it maybe about 3 months ago, 2 or 3 months ago, in December, yeah. And the ending of that movie brought me the closest I've been since I was a kid.
You were on the ropes, were you?
to a tear coming down my eye. I don't know why. It just, I don't know. It got me. I felt it. And I actually messaged him.
I said it nearly had you.
I said to him, a tear hasn't left my eye since I was 12 years old. Just watched Queen and Slim. The ending had me close. Powerful. That's the message I sent Daniel. I didn't cry, but you know,
you could feel it. You could feel it
coming up. And I haven't had that for a long, long time. So I was very shocked. I'm not an emotional guy in any sense. But you know, I have a personality. I'm a person, and I guess I never wanted. Or I always thought that, you know, emotions had to stay out of boxing, and I still kind of think they do. For me, some fighters, you know, you watch Manny Pacquiao walk to the ring, he's smiling and shaking hands, and for some people that just works. For me, I just
tunnel vision,
no emotion, you know, barbarian. That's the mindset I have going into a fight.
You did mention that confidence earlier, but to get confident, you have to have a treasure trove of experience, and experience of doubt and nerves, anxiety, and all that kind of stuff. Mental health is talked about a lot in today's day and age as well, when it wasn't discussed many, many moons ago. What's your take on that? And have you come through those periods in your life where you've doubted yourself?
Of course I've come through them. You know, I'm just trying to think if I've actually ever doubted myself. I've been, you know, disappointed with certain performances, but in terms of doubting myself as a fighter, as a human being, as a person, as a man, I don't think I've ever had that. I've had two losses, and, you know, you come out of the ring and you are disappointed. But at no stage did I ever think, maybe this isn't for me. Maybe I'm not the fighter I thought I was. Absolutely not. So in terms of that, you know, doubt, I don't think I have that. I'm very confident. I know who I am as a person. I know what I'm capable of. And that's what gives me my confidence going into these fights. I know I can never be broken.
How do you know that?
Because I've been through too much outside of the professional ring, in terms of sparring, in terms of, you know, training, in terms of life. I've been through too much. I've seen too much. I've done too much.
Of that you're referring back to your upbringing, so to speak, in Vegas, which transformed you from boy to man. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's definitely a big part of it. Yeah, Vegas. Just my whole life, nothing has ever broken me, and I've been in some shitty situations. I've been in some very tough times, in and out of boxing. But if you're going to keep it to the boxing, I've been through some very difficult times. I've had my ass handed to me in spars early on in my career. and I never once felt broken. Whereas some guys, you know, they can get hurt and they can, you know, that can put doubt into their minds about who they are as a fighter and what they can do and how far they can go. For me, you know, anytime I ever got hurt or anything like that, it was just, oh, you know, it's just a bad day. I'll be all right tomorrow. That self-belief that, you know, I was always able to come back bigger and better. Some guys don't have that, but you need that. You have to have that belief. You have to have that confidence that, you know, you can get through it. Mm. Because everyone goes through it. It's just how you come out on the other end.
Can you tell us a little bit about that grounding in Las Vegas? Because you were with Mike McCallum, weren't you, for a while? And there's a whole slew of big names that you're involved with. Yeah. In sparring. Did you spar Chad Dawson up there?
Chad Dawson, Zab Judah.
As a kid?
Yeah, as a kid, yeah. Loads of pros. Thrown in the ring with loads of pros at a young age and just, you know, let's see what you got, kid. Oh, you're Eubank, son. All right, well, I guess you're tough. Let's see what you got. They didn't care, you know. That was like the only amateur in the gym. This was at Top Rank. But Top Rank gym where they always used to train. That's where Floyd used to train, all these fighters. And I was probably the only amateur there under Mike McCallum. And, you know, some of them didn't think I should be there. You know, who is this guy? What? Because he's got a name, he's in our gym. Like, nah, we're gonna test him. And, yeah, you know, I took some bad beatings in that gym and at that stage in my life. And I was always in the gym the very next day, ready to go again. Getting my ass torn up in Cuba by the 2012 Cuban heavyweight Olympian.
Savon.
I don't know his name, yeah. But I do know he represented Cuba. And, you know, getting knocked out of the ring, getting back up, you know, falling onto concrete on my knees, my whole leg going dead, and just still getting back into the ring and taking the beating for three rounds. You know, when these things happen to you, you know, you understand, well, if that can't break me, if that can't stop me, if that guy can't knock me out, then who can?
Do you feel your mindset change, or did you feel your mindset change through that period?
Yes.
Where you became more stubborn and resolute?
Yeah, I mean, especially in Vegas, yeah, you know, it was... yeah, I mean, you find out who you are. You know, I wasn't used to getting beaten up, you know, before I went to Vegas. It just never happened. So, you know... Well, my dad said, you know, right, well, you know, if you're serious about it, you can go out there and you can see, you know, how much you really want to do this. That was the truth. Because and a lot of kids in my situation would have gone through that and thought, you know what, let me just go home and go back to school and hang out with my friends and, you know, this is not for me.
You had that early exposure to the British press when you went to Vegas, didn't you? Because was it the News of the World that put you on the front cover about your dad sending you out there or saying that you were going to be...
Yeah,
they basically said that you were adopted or something.
Yeah. Yeah, that was unfortunate.
Because if you read it, you could actually see that you hadn't been adopted or given away. You could see what was going on.
Yeah,
I mean, but the headlines told a different story.
Headlines are headlines. They've got to, you know... If the headlines were what it was, which is, oh, Chris Eubank Jr. has a legal guardian in Las Vegas, so no one cares. Chris Eubank Jr. given away by his father, adopted, that's like, wow, what's going on? But yeah, it was a legal guardianship. I was actually trying to get a green card at the time, going to school, boxing as an amateur. You know, you see how me and my father are, you see how involved he is with me. As if a man like that would ever think about giving away a son. This doesn't make sense. But, yeah, that was kind of my first yeah, in British press getting involved with my career or whatever. But, you know, that was a great time of my life. Aside from that, you know.
Aside from the beatings.
Aside from the beatings and, yeah, you know, the people talking about I was adopted or whatever, you know, aside from that, it was an amazing time of life. I was having, you know, I was in high school, which I loved. I got my high school diploma. I was fighting as an amateur, winning the Golden Gloves, going to the Nationals, my first 10 fights. You know, I was independent. It was a very, very fun time in my life. And, you know, those memories and that feeling and of a freedom, I guess, is what has made me now, you know, go back there. And I bought a place in Vegas. I just feel comfortable there, you know.
You have a place in Vegas now?
Yeah.
Yeah. There was one other thing that I just wanted to touch upon. There was another thing in the press, wasn't there? It was about punch up in a car park. And yep. How old were you then?
16 years old.
So 15 odd years removed from there now. Yeah. What was that about?
That was my life. That was what I was doing in England every other weekend. That was standard procedure for me. That was one of the reasons why I went to Vegas, to get away from that life I was living, that double life, that street life. And it was a double life, because after those situations, I was going home to a mansion and then waking up and then going to private school. But then once I'm out of private school, I'm back on the streets with these kids. I'm street fighting. I'm running around Brighton, running around the city and doing things I shouldn't do. You know, you're young, you're impressionable, you know, you got the older kids, you know, telling you, oh, you know, let's go here, we're going to do that and this. And, you know, I was boisterous. I had a lot of pent up aggression and energy, which I, you know, eventually learned, thank God, to channel into boxing. But this was kind of before I was really getting into the boxing, 15. So yeah, it was a kid making, doing, being young and dumb. And that was in the newspapers as well.
In the Vegas thing, and the moulding of you and those sparring sessions, was it in your mind that you were thinking, this is life now, because I'm going to be a pro?
At 17, 10 pro at 22, that was always my dream, yeah.
Yeah.
I always knew I wanted to be a professional, but you know, I knew that it was a long road. I knew I wasn't just going to be able to turn over, you know, turn pro overnight. I was going to have to serve my time. I was going to have to do these spars, do the training sessions, to have the amateur fights, and I knew that wasn't going to be anything quick. But yeah, that was always in my mind. You know, I've started boxing now. I love it. I would love to be on TV one day. So this is what I'm going to have to put up with. This is what I'm going to have to do and deal with and go through to be able to get to that stage. And it was, you know, no matter how hard it got, it was kind of like, well, at the end of it, you're going to get to fight on TV and you're going to get to be called a professional fighter. And so that makes all this worth it, you know. And I might make a couple of quid.
Is where you're at now in life, has it all been worth it?
Absolutely. For a long time, it was tough. Early on in my career, you know, not making like crazy money, you know, training every day, train journeys up to London just to sparring, and driving to Southampton, Littlehampton, and all these little towns, you know, driving hour and a half, 2 hours to get sparring every day. It was crap. But I mean, and I say that now looking back on it, but at the time I actually didn't, you know, I was just happy that I was doing what I loved. But looking back on it now, that was tough times. You know, I only really started making serious money, 2017?
What, you thinking the start of the Super Series?
Yeah.
So after the Quinlan fight?
Yeah.
So
yeah, before that it was, you know, I wasn't struggling, you know, I still had, you know, I was still, you know, fairly comfortable, I had an apartment and, you know, all that, but I wasn't free to do whatever I wanted, whenever I wanted, like I am now, you know, I had to, all right, got to be cool, got to be careful there and, you know, got to save money there and, you know, I was like everybody else. Maybe not like everyone else. I had some, you know, decent little paydays and stuff like that. But you know, it wasn't
life changing.
No, you know, I was still having to lead a fairly, you know, normal life, and the, you know, that coupled with having to be a fighter, you know, it's tough. It is a tough life. So, But I was still in love with the sport. I was still happy. I was always happy. So looking back on it now, from where I am now, yes, it was 100% worth it.
What's been the lowest point of your pro career so far? I can throw some suggestions.
Go ahead.
Lost to Billy Joe on points. The Nick Blackwell aftermath. George Groves. All of the above.
Yeah, I mean, those were probably the three toughest, you know, biggest, toughest times of my life, my pro career. Yeah, you know, I mean, there's been things that you wouldn't know about that I've had to go through during this stage in my life. Or during my pro career that I'm not going to talk about now, that were, you know, probably equally as bad. But if you're talking about just like my professional boxing, then yeah, those three were the toughest times. And it's just, you know, it's how you deal with those. You know, if you're going to talk about the Nick Blackwell situation, you know, that was. That was tough. And then obviously when he kind of came out of the coma and then said I was, called me a scumbag and, you know, was really unhappy with the fact that I had done what I'm supposed to do, which is talk about my fight, you know, and how upset him and his family were. And, you know, that was kind of like an extra, that just made it even worse. I really wasn't expecting that. And obviously, you know, when you're in that situation where somebody is seriously hurt, you know, you sit down and you think, all right, well, how am I going to be, you know, with my father when he had the Michael Watson incident and the whole, you know, him being paralyzed and all that. I think that actually affected him mentally in terms of like he couldn't
pull the trigger.
Yeah, he lost some of that killer instinct, some of that.
He became a bit gun shy in that. Yeah, respect, yeah.
And that was a thing people were asking me, like, you know, how are you gonna be moving forward? And I didn't let it. I was actually the opposite, if you can believe that. You know, I'd. Me being in that situation made me understand that these things are 100% real. It can happen to anybody. This isn't a book. This isn't a movie. You know, this guy died on the way to hospital. That could have been me. And I never want that to be me. So I'm going to be even more ferocious now. I'm going to train even harder. I'm going to fight even harder to make sure that doesn't happen to me. Because I've, you know, I've got so much I want to do.
Do you worry about your health, either long term with CTE and that kind of stuff, or short term, and obviously what happened to Nick? Does that stuff cross your mind, or do you not let it?
The short term stuff, definitely not. You just can't have it in your mind, because if you have it in your mind, it's going to happen, or the chances of it happening are going to increase. If you go into a fight thinking
it could be me,
oh shit, you know, I might get really hurt. Like, it's just, you just don't want that in your mind. It's dangerous. And long term stuff is different. Like, you know, I get reminded of every once in a while. I was actually watching a documentary a couple of days ago on Netflix.
Aaron Hernandez.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that makes you look at yourself. Obviously, football and boxing, two different things. But, you know, you're getting hit in the head.
Mm.
And, you know, there have been suicides in boxing. There have been deaths. So it makes you think, you know, how am I going to be when I'm retired? And, you know, it just makes you, me personally, it just makes me, I've just, keep your bloody hands up. Do not get hit. Keep that head moving. And that's always how I've been anyway. You know, my thing has been to take as little punishment as possible. And I guess that's why I don't have a lot of marks on my face. People who don't know boxing, or if you just meet me, they're like, you're a boxer. Wow. That's, but where's your broken nose? Where's your cuts? And I've only been cut once against Groves. Because I don't get hit. I work on defense. I work on getting out of the way of punches when I'm sparring. Sometimes I'll do sparring sessions where I'm not even throwing punches. My hands are just there and I'm letting the guy just throw away, and I'm just working on getting out of the way. Because every hit you're taking is, it's brain cells lost. And they do accumulate, and it does have an effect on you. You know, whether it's memory loss or headaches or all that stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, at this age now, you know, been doing it for so long, you do think about that type of stuff.
You're now number one for Canelo with the WBA.
Excellent. That is a fight that I've been calling out for some time now. So, you know, God willing, we can get that happening within the next 12 months.
How many fights have you got left for PBC? Two more?
at least one.
Okay.
At least one.
Canelo, though, I mean, tell me about that. You want that fight at middleweight? Or would you go up?
Yes. Listen, if he says fight me at heavyweight, then I'm coming up to heavyweight.
Show me the money, yeah.
You know, but ideally, I want to stay at middleweight. I felt very good, even though I didn't get to show it in the Khabarov fight. I felt very good. The weight came off amazing. So yeah, I really do want to campaign at middleweight for as long as I can. You know, I'm 30 years old. I've got a very fast metabolism. I don't know how long that's going to stay with me. So, you know, I want to make middleweight while I still can.
People are talking about Billy Joe Saunders and Callum Smith fighting Canelo this year, or in May, I think. Is it frustrating that your name's not in the mix, or are you okay with that, and do you envisage it happening just a bit further down the line?
I'm not going to say it's frustrating. You know, Canelo's not going anywhere. I don't think either of those guys will give him any type of problem. I don't think Saunders would ever take that fight anyway. He wants to fight easy opponents and look bad against them.
But so, money makes the world go round.
Yes, that is true. That is true. that is true. But yeah, I don't see any of those guys. I mean, if you're going off of performances, both of their last two performances were terrible. So I don't understand how... I don't understand the interest in seeing them fight Canelo. But, you know, if it happens, you know, fair play to them. Canelo isn't going anywhere, and I will get my shot.
Who do you see yourself fighting this year? Do you know? Are names already coming your way?
People are already talking about me and Charlo. That'd be a great fight. A aside from him, I've just said, you know, I want the belts. You know, wherever.
And a lot of them are over the road in DAZN when they got Munguia. Do you rate Munguia? Do you like that fight?
I don't know. I haven't seen him fight.
Okay.
I haven't seen him fight.
Danny Jacobs?
Yeah, Jacobs. Has he got a belt?
No, he's just fought Chavez. He's coming off a win over Chavez. Okay. So he'll be back in the picture. And obviously there's Golovkin as well, who's kicking around.
Would love to fight Golovkin. Would love that fight. Absolutely. That's the other name. I only say two names, Golovkin and Alvarez. You know, me and Golovkin do have a little history. I remember him tweeting about me a while back, saying that, you know, I don't have a pen or something like that. And that
stuck. Of course, because it was you he was due to fight when Cole Brook ended up coming in.
Yeah. Yeah, Eddie Hearn switched opponents last minute, gave the fight to Cole Brook stupidly. I don't know what money, obviously. And yeah, took that fight from me, and I've always wanted it ever since. So yeah, you know, if you're talking about names, that would be that's a big one on the list for me, Golovkin.
You've trodden your own path. Do you regret not having a more conventional approach to promotion and that kind of thing, in terms of going with Sky or in terms of going with BT and just sticking with one platform and going the way through, or do you like what you've done?
Do I like what I've done? Yes. From the Super Series onwards, I have had, you know, it's been a fighter's dream in terms of, you know, financial situation and, you know, the positions I've been put in, the fights I've had. So in that sense, I haven't needed to be with one person. If I was with one person, maybe it would have been harder for me to get into that Super Series, which has given me everything I've got now, or started that road anyway. And since then, it's been fight after fight after fight. And now I'm with Showtime, which is, you know, again, an extremely privileged position to be in with those guys. You know, everyone talks about DAZN and Matchroom, and, you know, they're not the only fish in the sea, fish in the pond. You know, they are doing some massive, massive things out there in America, and I'm happy to be a part of that journey at this moment in my life. I've done so much in England. You know, I'm not going to say there's nothing more I can do here, but I've done pretty much everything. I've had the super fights. I've had, you know, the filled out the O2. You know, fought the big names. There'll always be great fights for me to have out here, but at this stage, I feel like I needed to go somewhere where my name isn't, where I'm not the big fish in the pond, and have a chance to make myself a big fish in the biggest pond in the world.
Because that DeGale fight, in many respects, was a crowning achievement for you in this country, wasn't it?
Yep. I mean, that's, you know, that fight was years and years in the making. Every day for 5 years, I had someone coming up to me, "When are you going to fight DeGale? When are you going to give DeGale a go?" So that was a...
After that sparring session, or was it from before that even?
Yeah, after the sparring. Yeah. So the sparring session happened, we went on social media, the back and forths, then all the interviews, and, you know, just built and built and built and built and built. So to just get that off my chest was massive. And to do what I said I was going to do was massive.
Even George Groves came and had a selfie with you after that, didn't he?
Yeah, he was elated. I've never seen Groves so happy. Coming to the change room, giving me a hug. Thank you, man. Thank you. Yeah, I didn't realize how much he actually disliked DeGale until that day.
Yeah, I think theirs was probably might have been worse than you and James.
Yes. Well, I don't know. Probably the same.
You think you and James will ever shake hands and make up? You know, when you guys are old and crusty at boxing writers' dinners down in 30 years from now?
The girl isn't... I've got nothing against James. He's retired now, so...
Do you see what your dad's done with his rivals?
Yeah. Yeah, there's... I mean, you know, I don't hold grudges. Me and Saunders will never be... I don't think we'll ever be on that. You know, he is... he's a low life, in my opinion. So I can't ever say that me and him will...
break bread.
Yeah, he's a bad person. Aside from him, the girl was just dumb. He just said stupid things and, you know, you got to build the fight and whatever. But, you know, if I ever saw him again and he wanted to shake my hand, I got no problem with that. Groves, again, you know, bitter rivals leading up to the fight. Now, you know, the next fight, he's in my change room shaking hands and hugging me. So it's you know, I'm not...
Helps when you've made each other an obscene amount of money.
Yes, that does help. But even that still doesn't give you a pass if you are a bad person.
Sure.
So yeah, you know.
Have you met Michael Watson, Nigel Benn, and Steve Collins?
Yes, I have.
Like them all?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I didn't fight him. My dad did. Obviously, Watson, met him quite a few times. Lovely guy. Nigel, been around him a couple of times, trained around him a little bit. And
Steve Collins.
Steve Collins, yeah, I'm pretty sure I've met him quite a few times. I met his son before.
What do you make of Conor Benn? Do you appreciate his struggle?
Of course, you know, it's the same struggle as me, you know. We're walking in the same path.
Do you ever swap messages?
No, we've talked a few times, but you know, we're not mates. You know what I mean, but there's still people who think that one day me and him are gonna have a fight.
Who'd you like to watch in boxing now?
Who do I like to watch? I like to watch... mine's gone blank. What's his name? The guy does ballet, who did ballet.
Lomachenko?
Yeah. I forgot that name. Yeah. Lomachenko, great, great, great fighter to watch. Obviously, AJ, always exciting to watch him.
Have you got a take on this Fury Wilder rematch?
I don't think Fury will beat Wilder. Fury has to box perfectly for 12 rounds to win. Wilder just has to land one shot. He has to win 1 second of any fight. So the odds, in my opinion, are stacked against Fury. Big time. And I wasn't that impressed with his last fight either.
The Thomas Schwartz one.
Sorry,
the Otto Waller one. Yeah.
Saying that, I wasn't impressed with Wilder's last fight at all until he catches him. Mm. And then it's just like, wow, this guy's an animal. But up until that, it was pretty terrible, actually, you know, in my opinion. I was at that fight, you know.
Let me ask you what happened with Adam Booth, because you had a period where you were considering him as a trainer, he was considering you as a fighter. What happened?
Adam,
because he's always rated you. I remember him telling me after you'd been up sparring with George Groves, and I think Nathan Cleverly was in camp at the time at the old Haymaker gym, and he's always rated you. So it was, in many ways, it was a shame that it didn't work out.
You know, everything happens for a reason. The you know, we were. We're both two strong personalities. And I guess, you know, at one point, you know, we always got along. It was good. I enjoyed training with him, but the situation that happened, which actually ended it for us, Michael Venom Page came down to my gym for sparring. Do you know that? Have you heard this before?
No.
I didn't actually know who he was at the time.
He's an MMA guy, right?
Yeah. I think he's had. He's had some boxing fights as well. I think he fought with like David Haye, but on like some type of boxing show at one point.
Sure.
And I was actually a commentator for it.
Oh, and yeah, okay.
So yeah, he came down for sparring. Get ready, jump in the ring, spar one round, and the spar finishes, and it's he was doing all this crazy stuff that he does in the MMA and stuff. And I was like, who the hell is this guy? Like, well, I didn't know who he was. So yeah, the bell goes back to his corner. I say, you know, just so you guys know, it's 30-second rest. That's what I've done my entire career. That's how it is in my gym. Even when I spar in other people's gyms, it's 30-second rest. But especially in my gym. So just the bell's going to go to 30-second rest. And I think his trainer said, no, we only do, we do 1 minute rest. I said, okay, that's great that you guys do 1 minute. But in this gym, my gym, it's 30 seconds. So I'll see you guys out in 30 seconds. And they said, no, sorry, we're not doing 30-second rest. I said, well, all right, well, that's fine if you don't want to do it. There's other guys that are literally waiting to get in the ring to spar with me, so you guys are welcome to leave. And I looked at Michael and I said, like, if you don't do 30 seconds, then just jump out and I'll see you later, mate. And he looked at his trainer and he's like, he got out, which was quite embarrassing, really. I mean, if I'm sparring somebody and they say it's 30-second rest, and I would never then jump out of the ring, even if I was uncomfortable with it, I wouldn't jump out of the ring. That's just, it's against the warrior code, as my father would say. So he got out of the ring, and you know, his trainer was upset, and he was saying, making a big scene about it. And they walked out, and Adam Booth, who was with me at the time, walked out with them, which is, amazing to me. You know, you're my trainer, your team Eubank, but because you were upset with the fact that I'd ran these guys out of the gym, you walked out with them. And that was the point where I knew that we wouldn't be able to
gel.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Not even gel. I mean, it's, I can't have a trainer that's going to take someone else's side. I mean, even if I was wrong, which I don't think I was, even if I'm dead to rights wrong, you are with me. So
you're against me, with me or against me.
No, you're with me.
Yeah,
you're my trainer, so you have to stick by me. Even if I'm doing the completely wrong thing, stick by me as my trainer and have my back. He didn't have my back that day. So that was the end of it.
Ronnie still in the team?
Absolutely. Ronnie is he's the foundation of the team. Ronnie, he's been there from the beginning and he'll be there till the end.
So you mentioned right at the start about people ask you what happens in the next 2 or 3 years. Are you still going to be fighting in 2 or 3 years?
Absolutely. I'm 30 years old and I feel amazing. If Floyd can fight until 40, then I've got at least 5-6 years left of good, effective boxing. And then after that, I can just... I mean, if people still want to watch me fight, which I'm sure they will, then I lower competition, I don't have to campaign at the world level. I mean, obviously, that's the dream, to be able to still do that at 37, 38, 39.
You wouldn't go back to domestic level, surely.
Well, I don't know. I don't know how my body's going to be in 8-9 years. And maybe I won't be able to stick with the young guns of that age.
Yeah.
You know, that's what happens. You become a target, you're a name and you become a target to the up and coming guys who want your name on their
resume.
On their resume. And I don't ever want to be that guy who's just giving my name away to these young kids on my resume. But, you know, I don't know. You know, the dream is to be able to be like a Floyd where you can still operate at the world level at that age.
On your terms.
Yeah. But even then, you still have to be smart. There's still some guys that you should stay away from, and, you know, you got to be smart. You can't go and you can't be 39, 40 years old and be like, I want to fight that absolute number one guy. Like, it's going to be tough, you know. So you got to be smart. But, you know, right now, amazing, feel amazing, strong, fit, best shape I've been in. So, yeah, I think 4 or 5 years of prime boxing left in me.
Are you ready for a tough transition into civilian life, so to speak, after boxing? When you see particularly ex-fighters, but a lot of former athletes and stars either go down the wrong path, lose fortunes or whatever it is, struggle with depression, even when they've left on their own terms, a lot of the guys have struggled over the years.
That's not me. I'm very I'm very happy. I'm very comfortable as a with who I am and as a person, as a man. If I had to stop boxing tomorrow, I don't have the mentality to just go off the rails. I'm very level-headed, I'm very grounded. I've got a lot of good people around me all over the world. I have great friends, great contacts. So, you know, I can go anywhere and be happy and have fun and relax and, you know, made great investments. I'm still making great investments every time I have a fight and have a payday. The money is going to the right places. It's not being spunked on crap. You know, it's building itself. So I have a solid foundation. I'm not going to have to, you know, sell my soul to make a couple of quid after I retire and the money stops coming in through boxing. So, you know, I'm not worried about that stage of my life when I'm not in the ring. But I'm not even, you know,
you're not there,
you're asking me about it. I never even think about it. Yeah. You know, it's just not a thought.
Marriage and kids, is that a thought?
Kids, definitely. 100%. Got to have some kids at some point. Marriage, I'm not too sure about. That's a tough one because it's, you know, you look around. You know, my parents. I don't know. The statistics are crazy on how successful most marriages are. Like, I think it's like 50% fail in the first.
It used to be 1 in 3, but that was years ago. Now I'm sure it's worse than that.
Yeah. So, you know, it's tough to believe in that system. When you look around and you know your friends and you no one's still together, so it's like, well, do I want to go down that same road? Do I need to? So marriage is that's kind of, you know, put a pin in that one. That's not really in my mind at this moment. But kids for sure.
And what if the kids come to you and say, "Daddy, we want to start boxing"?
How could I say no? My father said no. But eventually, you know, after a couple of years of...
Well, how could you say no? We mentioned Nick Blackwell. We've mentioned damage after boxing, from boxing. That you have compelling arguments. You could obviously say to... You could point to Michael Watson and Nick Blackwell, two generations of it.
Yeah.
You could make a compelling case. And obviously, part of the reason what you want to do now is, when you do have kids, is to have some generational wealth... To make sure, so you're making the sacrifices, they don't have to.
Absolutely, yeah. And that was a big thing for why my dad probably said no, because, you know, I've done the hard work, so that you don't have to. So yeah, I mean, I would never say, son, come on, we're going to the gym. You know, you're going to put some gloves on and you're going to box. I would never do that. But I don't see how I could say to my son or my daughter, And the daughter's a tough one. That's a much tougher decision than the son. I don't see how I could say to them no because of everything that I've got from the sport. It wouldn't make sense, you know. It wouldn't be fair, you know. So I would have to, and I think I would want to let them try it. I would never force them into it, but I would let them test the path, and you know,
before committing 100%. Yeah. See what it, yeah.
Because some of these things are phases. I went through loads of phases as a kid, you know, skateboarding, yo-yos, Pokemon. Sometimes you know, you just want to do something for a bit and just, you know, and then eventually it just falls off.
Mm.
You know, a lot of kids, that's what boxing is. You know, they'll go to the gym, oh, I've got some gloves on, I'm cool, I'm punching people in here. And then, you know, after a while, you know, I'm going to do something else now.
Do you love it, boxing?
You've got to. People ask me that all the time, do you love it? You absolutely have to. If you're doing it for any other reason than the love of the sport, you're going to get hurt and you're not going to make it. You know, some people, especially early on in my career, was like, oh, well, he's just doing it for the money. He's going to make a quick payday, have a couple of fights, make some money, and then go on Big Brother or something like that. You know what I mean? And that's fair enough because, you know, I could have easily done that. But if you're doing it for those reasons, for those superficial reasons, for money or fame or whatever, you're just never going to make it. Because there's going to be so many times where you're going to be in positions where it's going to be so painful, so hard, so gritty, that you're going to, if you were only in it for those reasons, you'd be like, you know what? Screw this! I'm gonna find another way. The only way that you can get through those moments is if you love the sport. If you're actually looking forward to getting back into the gym the next day to work on your craft and become a better fighter.
Chris, I really appreciate your time. I love chatting to you. I really do. I find it really engaging. I find you really interesting, and just not the sort of person that you expect when you see you on the TV. Not necessarily doing fight interviews, but when you're expressionless and when you're stoic and you're there strutting, you look like you might be arrogant. You look like you might be this, you might be that, but you're not. I enjoy your company.
In the ring, I am.
Yeah.
In the ring, but...
There's a difference.
People have got to understand, when you're about to engage in combat with another man in front of millions of people... You're not the guy you are when you wake up on a Sunday morning or a Monday and you're just chilling. You can't be. You know, it's intense. It's scary, and it's everybody deals with it in their own way. My way is to be stoic and emotionless, and I'm going to get the job done. But that's not how I am. Every day of the week, you can't be that way unless you're some type of, you know, killer assassin who, you know, I'm a normal human being, but on the night, I'm not a normal human being. And I guess some people only know me for what they see on these boxing nights. And there's more of that. And I guess, you know, if you want to see the other side of me, Snapchat, Instagram, Facebook, and you'll get to know a little bit more about me.
Even then, I don't think that gives it away. You're too polished.
Yeah?
You're too polished on that stuff.
I mean, you know...
Instagram for sure.
Yeah, but if you're talking about like... if you're talking about like the main post, but if you do go on my Instagram story, like even now, have you seen my Instagram story right now?
I haven't, no.
Yeah, Instagram story, Snapchat. So...
I'll check it when I
Yeah. Know. Check it out as soon as you leave, and you'll see. And that's the type of stuff that's being posted on a fairly regular basis. And that's the type of stuff that makes you understand that I'm a good guy.
Yeah. Brilliant. Well, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it. And looking forward to seeing you get back out there sooner rather than later.
Yes.
Thank you very much. For me, there's not much not to like about Chris Eubank Jr. I like the fact he's got something to say for himself. I like the fact that He calls a spade. If he likes someone, fine. If he doesn't, that's also fine. You know, hey, you meet people. There aren't many people in this world that I particularly don't like, but you do meet them. And it's one thing saying that you don't like them, and it's another thing saying they're okay, but actually thinking you don't like them. Chris doesn't have any of those complexities where you say one thing and mean another. He says what he means and means what he says. Interesting guy, super cool guy to spend some time with. Like I said, there's layers to him. And I think, you know, this isn't in a patronizing way at all. He's 30 years old, not had kids. And I think there's probably, you know, and I suppose where I was coming from that is not cried in so long. There's probably a dam that's built up in Chris Eubank Jr. that will explode at some point, and the emotions will come running out, because when he talks about the stuff that's happened to him, some of it quite traumatic, to have not shed a tear through that time, it's probably not the healthiest thing in the world. You know, we did talk about mental health there, and he has a good grasp of it, a good understanding of it. But until it happens to you, it's hard to put into words how it will affect you and how it feels. So there might come a point in his life where there's a trigger, and then this 2 decades of where he's gone without a tear will just cause a cascade of emotions to seep from him. And you know what? That's not a bad thing. That's a healthy thing if it happens. If you don't have to go through it, then that's cool. But if you do, then like I said, that it's healthy. There's nothing wrong with that at all. I thought, you know, about that conversation, I thought that was great. It was flawless. You know, I think he tried to maybe steer me away from maybe the car park stuff and, you know, with some of his earlier answers. But, you know, we still went back to it and he addressed it for me. And it's one of those things. It's very difficult. You know, obviously, as a life story, you want to cover as much ground as possible. But at the same time, it's like, you know, how far back do you go back to hit people over the head with the stick with? You know, for example, I've seen Mike Tyson fly up at people when people ask him about the Desiree Washington case in Indianapolis, and I kind of get that. You know, he served his time, he got off with it. It was, what, 1992, God, 10, 20, nearly 30 years ago now. So, you know, but can you do an in-depth interview with him without bringing it up? You know, it's a tough one, because, you know, this is a guy who not only said he didn't, I'm referring to Tyson here, not only said he didn't assault Desiree Washington in the first place, but he served his time, he's paid his price, he's paid his dues, paid what the system made him pay. And, you know, does that mean that we should still keep bringing it back to that time and time again? You see Mike react in interviews. There's clips, in-depth clips on YouTube and doing the rounds on social media where he's snapping at journalists who are still asking him about the same thing 30 years on. I guess there's only so many times you want to talk about that thing, and that's understandable. In terms of Chris Eubank Jr., it's probably not a PR thing to try and bring that up. It's probably a little bit of a taboo thing for him to be talking about, but the fact that he didn't shirk it, and the fact that he didn't say, you know, moving swiftly on or anything else, shows a level of maturity and understanding that the Chris Eubank Jr. that was around then tearing up the streets of Brighton is not the same Chris Eubank Jr. That we see today. In fact, just reverting to that and moving on from that, I think at the end of that interview, he said about checking out his Instagram stories. And for some reason or another, I hadn't seen a story of his for a while. I went and looked at his Instagram stories. The ones he'd uploaded about a day before I'd come out to see him, and there he was in the Brighton Hove Boxing Club, working through some moves with kids and young amateurs and showing them the ropes. So, you know, it's yet another example, and he referred to AJ in that interview a couple of times, another example of how boxing can help rehabilitate people and how it can help give them hope and give them a future and give them prospects, when otherwise the future may have been bleak without having boxing in their lives. It's a big moral thing for boxing, the fact that it's done so much for so many in that respect. Still, I think that's more than enough of me waffling on for this week. I'm really grateful for you for listening. if you've made it this far. And obviously super grateful as always to our sponsors. Hanson Lee Resourcing, they're a multi-award winning provider of technology and business change professionals across the UK, Europe, US and Asia Pacific regions. Not only do they find the best people, but they'll help you retain them. Discover more at hansonlee.com. Delco Safety Compliance are a leading provider of professional fire, asbestos and safety services to businesses nationwide. They offer one expert point of contact for all your fire, health and safety compliance needs. Find out more at www.delcosafety.co.uk. I'm actually heading off to America with BT Sport this week, so I hope to bring you some interviews from the US again. But if not, regardless of that, I'll be back next week.